welcome to a special membership drive edition of The Film Show on KVU. I'm SW Conser, and I'm joined live in the studio by a celebrated film historian who's recently relocated from San Francisco to Portland, Elliot Levine. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Well, we're going to be asking you about the course that you are overseeing, Film Noir and the Blacklist, in just a few minutes. But first, I am joined on the line from Seattle by Jeff Unai. Jeff is a first-time filmmaker whose new documentary, The Cage Fighter, will be screening at the Northwest Film Center as part of their Northwest Tracking series. Jeff, it's great to have you on the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, tell us about The Cage Fighter. This is a film that Variety magazine called a real-life Rocky.
Yeah, we've heard a lot of the comparisons of all the different movies, Raging Bull, The Wrestler. Starting the project, I didn't really think that we would ever be compared to those really big, gigantic fiction, narratives. Every review seems to kind of bring those up. But, it's a classic story of, someone that's really just trying to find themselves and someone that's kind of going through a struggling time in their life. And for this man, Joe, he goes back to cage fighting, and it's something that he didn't tell his family that he was doing. So all this unfolds in the film.
Yeah, the subject of your film, well, the difference between those movies you mentioned and your film, The Cage Fighter, is that yours is a documentary.
And it's real. It's all verite. Yeah.
And the subject, he is not a young guy. He's going into the ring with young guys and his family. You get intimate moments that are kind of amazing, that they really let you in to the private spaces.
I always kind of felt like, the fight's always going to be outside of the ring. You know, if anytime you ever meet a boxer or a fighter or anyone that's in combat sports, you really start kind of dissecting and talking to them, and there are things that they're battling internally. So that's the kind of stuff that I was more interested in versus the winning and the losing. And in the beginning of the film, you know, we make it pretty clear that this film isn't about winning and losing. This is a universal story here.
So you had some really interesting, well, you have a background, first off, as a cinematographer and a still photographer. Mm-hmm. You're partial to black and white still photography.
Yeah, I love it, yeah.
Yeah, and so you've worked on many films, many crews, doing behind the camera. This is your first feature film.
Directorial, yes. Yeah, it's first time I've directed a film. I've shot films, I've been cinematographer on a few, and also have done artwork, visual effects, and sculpting. But this is the first time I've ever directed, so I've learned a lot.
So you have, like I said, you had this background as a still photographer, and mm-hmm. so you're not a traditional sort of, you're not a traditional part of the Hollywood scene, and you didn't do a traditional route to making this film. You didn't get money through some of the normal channels, some of the studios, not even through crowdfunding. You did some really interesting work with a couple of groups. Tell us about this.
Yeah, when I started this project, it was something that I was doing because I wanted to exercise my own personal creativity and to find my voice in the stories that I want to tell. And there were opportunities to fund the film in kind of your typical routes. This is an indie film through and through. You know, a lot of people want to put the indie label on their big gigantic films with all these mega stars. But, if you guys want to come out and see what a real indie, any way you can make this film, a lot of it was self-funded. Primarily, and I was lucky enough to get sponsored by some really amazing organizations. CineReach is our biggest supporter. They're out of New York, and Sundance Institute, They've helped us quite a bit going through different labs, Points North out in Maine. So
Points North is where you workshopped the script, right? Or the film itself?
Yes, I was actually able to workshop and show work in progress clips in lots of different places. When I went to Sundance Institute, we were in L.A., and we screened it there as a work in progress. And CineReach in New York, they helped us quite a bit with a lot of screenings. And every screening that you go to, or every time you screen your film, you just see it through a lot of people's eyes or a new perspective on it. And that kind of informs what's clear and what's confusing and whatnot. So I highly suggest anyone that's making a film that, they need to workshop it. And not to mention, I workshopped this film for the very first time at the Oregon Doc Camp at Silver Lake Falls in Sublimity. Have you ever been out there? It's so beautiful.
Sublimity is beautiful, yes.
It's so gorgeous. Yeah, that was the first time I've ever shared any of my work with anyone publicly. And that's kind of how this all started. This screening started with a partnership through Northwest Film Center and the Oregon Doc Camp. Yeah.
Well, your film, The Cage Fighter, is playing at the Northwest Film Center. It's part of the Northwest Tracking Series. Listeners can catch it on Thursday, May 10th at the Art Museum. There's more information at nwfilm.org. And Jeff, you got any other new projects coming up that you'd like to tell us about?
Oh, I'm constantly workshopping, large and small ideas, and always staying busy. I love film, so it's something I plan on doing more.
Well, Jeff Unai, thank you for joining us today on the Film Show.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, appreciate it.
All right, you're listening to the Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser. In just a minute, we'll be sitting down with film historian Elliot Levine. But first, we want to offer you the opportunity to join KBOO today and take home a one-of-a-kind thank you gift. When you call toll-free 877-500-KBOO and talk to one of our volunteers, you can get yourself a pair of tickets to the Northwest Film Center. You might want to check out Jeff Unai's film, which is The Cage Fighter, coming up on May 10th. Or you might want to catch any of the other offerings that you can find there at the Northwest Film Center. So any regular screening is available at the Northwest Film Center when you call toll-free 877-500-KBOO. You can also go online at kboo.fm. So yeah, don't wait. Become a member of your community radio station today. And while you're calling KBOO, we have a clip to play for you. It's from the 1947 film Brute Force. It's a little teaser. It's playing as part of the Film Noir and the Blacklist series at Cinema 21.
Here, behind the grim walls and bristling battlements of Westgate Penitentiary, live the men of our story. You would call it a prison, but to those who know, it is one big human bomb ready to explode. Yeah! Yeah! Here are the conflicts and hates, the desires and dreams of men who chose to live by brute force and now are chained by it. Burt Lancaster, star of The Killers, ruthless ruler of the mob inside.
Nothing's okay. It never was and it never will be. Not till we're out. Get that out.
Hume Cronin, a rat in uniform.
I'm the only one who can help you.
Captain, I'm a cheap thief. I know I'm a failure, but I'm not an informer.
And now we're joined in the studio by Elliot Levine. Elliot is a film historian whose latest screening class course is called Film Noir and the Blacklist. Elliot, great to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, Willamette Week recently quoted Mick LaSalle, a longtime critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. LaSalle said that moviegoers in Portland don't yet know what they've been missing. San Francisco's loss is Portland's gain. So you are here from San Francisco, where you've been doing a lot of work down there.
40-plus years in San Francisco, mostly connected with the Roxy Theater in the Mission District, which... is the oldest operating theater in San Francisco. It's well over 100 years and had a reputation as being a very adventurous, sort of radical, politically motivated art house. And I had a wonderful association there for many, many years and wound up teaching film classes down at Stanford, largely as a result of my association with the Roxy. And so it's great that I can transfer all this wonderful stuff out here in Portland.
Well, did you have a bit of trepidation moving to Oregon from California?
Not really. I think I might have if we had done it sooner, but it felt like the right time. And my wife and I figured, well, let's just do it. And we did it.
It takes a little time for Portlanders to warm to newcomers. But really, they just want to make sure you're not a Silicon Valley tech bro who's here to buy up all the little craftsmen.
Well, the
houses.
First thing we did do, we got new license plates for the car, so that helped a little bit.
Yeah, as long as you're not going to tear down a little bungalow for a McMansion, you're
right.
Good. So this is actually the second series of films that you've curated for Cinema 21.
And well, this one's a little different. Actually, I did two series for Cinema 21, but those were sort of commercial series for the public. This too is for the public, but it's done under the auspices of Oregon State University. So technically, it's a class. It's a class that you can actually register and sign up for. We're only 2 weeks into it, so people can probably still do that if they want to. Because there's still a lot of incredible films to be shown. And our discussions around these films have been incredibly lively, as you might imagine. The sort of incendiary nature of The Blacklist is still a subject that is very sensitive for a lot of people. The implications that a condition like this could exist in a country that promotes democracy is kind of hard to swallow. And even people who are in the class watching these films, learning about filmmakers whose careers were ended simply because of their political associations, in some instances, maybe 20 years earlier, is a bit of a shocking revelation. So I think it's important that people have an opportunity to see these films under the collective context of a Blacklist historical approach to film. The films by themselves are incredibly entertaining. They're genre films. They're exciting. They're meant to be escapist entertainment, but they're made by subversive people who had interesting messages that they wanted to convey to the public. That's when all the real problems with the House Un-American Activities Committee came up, because they were all too aware of how effectively the Germans used film as a propagandistic tool during the war, all through Hitler's regime. And this was not lost on American politicians, particularly the ones who were on the staunch conservative side of things. They saw this as something that was happening in this country, that people with subversive ideas were making little gangster movies and cowboy movies that carried very subversive messages, and either anti-capitalistic or just anti-authority. You'd see it come alive in Westerns, where a posse would appear suddenly, and lynch law would be kind of a common practice. Prison movies were often real fertile ground for subversive ideas, with the prison authorities standing in for government people, prisoners standing in for the common man who's been tread upon. So this was all real fertile area. And of course, it made the government very nervous that millions of people, unsuspecting people, would be walking in to see a gangster movie and come out politically radicalized and not even really necessarily know it. So that was a major concern. It was illogical concern, but it was based on fear and paranoia.
Well, you mentioned the House Un-American Activities Committee, and some youngsters might have been introduced to some of that history. A recent film that had Bryan Cranston in it about Dalton Trumbo, who was a screenwriter. The folks in Congress who were going out looking for Reds in the society, they especially were hitting hard in Hollywood. And I guess it was because Hollywood was so effective back in the 40s and 50s. And like you say, having a lot of you know, having a bit of wide latitude with the B movies, because back in the days of Hollywood double features, B movies were traditionally the lesser half of a double bill. So they didn't have a reputation for being artsy. They tend to be kind of lean in terms of budget and script.
Right. Well, their reputation for being artsy would come later, when people sort of got rid of the notion, the incorrect, erroneous notion that these films are not worthy of our attention, because a lot of really brilliant artists, cinematographers, directors, were really creating these films, either because they were at the very beginning of their career, and that's where they needed to be, or in some cases, they were literally at the very end of their career, and the only work they could find was working for the low-budget so-called Poverty Row studios, or in the B units of the bigger studios. So these films became exactly the types of films that would get under the skin of people connected to the government at that time, largely because there was really not a whole lot of control over these films. They were too busy over on Studio A watching the new Clark Gable film being made and making sure that every little detail was just right. And if somebody was over, you know, in the shadowy corners making a little gangster picture, well, they weren't going to get a whole lot of scrutiny. So these films sort of went by. In a way, they were almost as close to being uncensored as a film could possibly be at that time, when you consider that the production code was still very much in effect.
Well, I understand that the Hays Code, or the Motion Picture Production Code, was, this was a set of moral guidelines for Hollywood. It was in effect from the early 20s through the end of World War II, so it kind of trailed off in the 40s.
Well, it was being used less effectively, but okay. It was still very much there. In fact, it was pretty much there until the end of the 60s or the mid-60s, when films started becoming a little bit more adult in content. But it was forcing the issue. In the 30s and 40s and even in the 50s, there was a real sense of intrusion, that films were taking it upon themselves to just take on too much, whether it's what they showed or how they expressed it through dialogue. So there really was a strong watchdog presence in Hollywood. But it was the B units that tended to get away with more, simply because they were unsupervised. It was having a lot of bright kids at summer camp, but no counselors. And it was kind of a very short-lived paradise.
It's
funny. It turned awful. It turned very ugly.
It's funny that nowadays the traditional B-movie genres, like gangster, sci-fi, and action films,
yeah,
these are the movies that now have the big budgets, and some of them have run times of 2 or 3 hours.
There's a weird irony to that. I mean, in the days when a typical film would run 70 minutes, it would be in black and white, and people would talk about it for months and sometimes years. So the whole idea of B-movie has really kind of... It's morphed into something completely different. B to me stands for better, and it'll probably always be that way.
Well, coming up this weekend, you're doing the film Brute Force,
yeah,
and the director is French-born Jules Dassin.
He's born in America.
Oh, he's born in America. I thought he was French.
He was an absolute American guy, okay, which is really kind of funny, because once he was blacklisted and had to leave the country in order to work, he wound up in France, and his most famous film is a film called Rififi,
right,
which is a heist movie. It's a French noir film. And most people just assumed that Dassin was French, because
well,
he made this
did.
Brilliant French film. And he continued to work all throughout Europe. It took probably until he was quite an old fellow.
So Dassin was escaping the blacklist when he went to France, and really some people credit him with seeding film noir overseas, and it really started to get the respect it's due. Jean-Pierre Melville and Henri Georges Clouzot took over took up the torch there. Oh, and you know, more recently you see great neo-noir directors coming out of Japan, like Seijun Suzuki and Takeshi mm-hmm. Kitano.
Well, they all, yeah, especially Kitano, simply because Kitano would inject a very heady kind of philosophical component to the film, which Dassin did as well. If you look at Brute Force, yes, you're taken with the immediacy of the movie. It's incendiary. It's a real violent film. It'll get your emotions going. But below all that, it's a very deeply sensitive and philosophical film. And he touches on issues which in a prison film are very unusual, and it made certain people very uncomfortable, particularly when all the authority figures are either presented as fascists or alcoholics. You get the sense that, well, sooner or later you're going to say, well, I'm going to side with the prisoners because they're a lot more appealing. And if you look at Brute Force again, you'll realize that none of the prisoners who are there, the ones who are occupy the main focus, none of them have done anything really terrible. One guy robbed a place, but he needed the money because his wife needed an operation. And that's why he did it. That's why he did the crime. And everybody else's crimes were sort of like that. None of them were vicious criminals, but yet they were being treated so viciously, which again is a very pointed sort of reminder that the inequality in the systems that are part of this country were really never all that fair to begin with. And putting it into a genre movie like this is, in the eyes of some people in the government, was a very dangerous thing to do. It's going to get people thinking and not liking what they see.
It sounds similar to what Rod Serling was doing in television later in The Twilight Zone, taking social issues and putting them in, you know, science fiction guises. And
you know, Serling is a perfect sort of extension of that, because he saw an opportunity. I mean, films had already kind of come of age by the late 50s, and they were making serious, important statements about life in America. So Serling took it to the next logical step, is let's put it on the small screen. It's easy to do. It's inexpensive to do. And he created an incredible movement. And that sort of TV programming became kind of the rule for a while. Because he started out in the late 50s, and by the mid-60s, that's the only kind of TV you'd be seeing, really. The film, hour-long episodes that had a specific social message, and very unusual. You didn't really see that so much in the 50s, but you did see it a lot in the 60s, largely because of Serling.
What are some of the other films that you've got in the film noir and the Blacklist series that are coming up?
Well, we started out with Body and Soul, which is the great John Garfield film, which probably has more blacklisted people in it or connected to it than any other film. Literally, the entire cast was blacklisted. The writer was blacklisted, Abraham Polonsky. The director, Robert Rawson, was blacklisted, as was the producer of the film, Bob Roberts. The real interesting case in that film was Robert Rawson, the director. This is 1947 when this film came out. He'd been writing screenplays in Hollywood since the mid-30s, and they were all socially conscious kinds of screenplays, proletariat kind of screenplays, working class people being undermined by authority figures. It was that kind of like relentless approach. And so he was a natural to sort of drift into this kind of area to direct a film. But the film wound up being an incredible, controversial film that resulted in the end of a lot of careers. And Rawson, the director, was singled out as well because he was the director of the film and he had been an admitted member of the Communist Party in the 1930s. So this all played very heavily. And when he went up before the committee, he refused to cooperate, and he was blacklisted. And he had to, his next two films, he had to go overseas to make. But once he realized that this was going to be his life and his fate, he relented, and he decided to cooperate with the House Un-American Activities Committee. He was back in America, and by 1949 or 50, he was back making films. So he wound up sort of on the other side of it, but he paid a price for it. He didn't pay a price as severe as Elia Kazan, for example, who he named a lot of names. He was like a scourge in terms of the left-wing community in Hollywood. But Rawson was different. I mean, he did have to endure some punishment, but he didn't really name names. He cooperated, but not to the extent that Kazan did. But it was still a black mark on his reputation.
Well, this is fascinating. Film noir and the Blacklist is continuing at the Cinema 21 through May. And Elliot Levine, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And we hope that you'll be able to come back sometime when you have a new series coming up.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
And how can listeners find out more about your work and your
Well, classes? They can go online. They can look at the Cinema 21 website. They could go to the OSU website, or they could just Google me and they can find out what they want to know if they really are interested in doing that.
L-A-V-I-N-E.
That's the way.
All right. Well, thanks again to our guests today, Elliot Levine and Jeff Unai. Thanks also to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration. And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. The audio for this show will be available later today on our archive page, kboo.fm/thefilmshow. And you can keep up with us on Twitter at @kboofilmshow. Before we go today, we want to make sure that you, the listener, have an opportunity to become a member of KBOO today and take home a one-of-a-kind thank you gift, especially for fans of the film show. Here are my friends, Del and Ken, with all the details. Hello, you two. How's everything going today?
Oh, hi, Conch. Actually, I'm with Bill Dodge now.
Oh, excellent.
He just came in.
Excellent. Film buff Bill Dodge.
Oh, definitely. In fact, it was funny because we were talking about The Twilight Zone a little earlier, and I noticed that Elliot Levine mentioned that as kind of an extension of film noir and Hollywood making more serious films.
Oh, thanks.
So this is our spring membership drive. We're into it about a week. We've got another week to go, but there's no better time to become a member. I know it's a beautiful day out. Take a few minutes out of your day. If you're not already a KBOO member, give us a call at 877-500-5266. You can also go online at kboo.fm. And Bill, I wanted to very quickly let listeners know that if they're interested in what Elliot Levine had to say, and of course he was talking about Cinema 21, we do have five pairs of tickets to the Northwest Film Center, another great center of film history here in Portland, for a $60 donation, a minimum $60 donation, and we can do that at $5 a month for a sustaining membership. You get a pair of tickets to any regular screening at the Northwest Film Center for $60. Give us a call, 877-500-5266, to take advantage.
And become a member now and be entered to win a prize. Today's drawing is for $200 for John Fluvog shoes. Call 877-500-5266 now to be entered for a chance to win. Or go to kboo.fm for rules and details on all the prizes. And then we've also got some folks to thank. Chris from Southeast Portland. He got the book No Immediate Danger. Thank you, Chris. And Pam from Sandy got the Palast book and DVD. And last but not least, Barry came in to the station here at 20 Southeast 8th over by the Doug Fir and made a donation in person, which you can do too. Thanks a lot to everybody for doing that.
And we should mention that, Bill, we welcome visitors to KBOO.
Absolutely.
Again, that's 20 Southeast A, so it's about a half block south of East Burnside, right next to Doug Fir, as Bill mentioned, across the street from Grendel's Coffee Shop and Le Pigeon. You wouldn't think it would be in our neck of the woods, but it is one of the fanciest restaurants in the city. So come on by. We'd be happy to give you a tour of the studio to show, if you are a member or you're thinking of becoming one, where your money goes. It's not the fanciest digs in town, but it gets the job done. We have several production studios. We do training here too for volunteers. They can train to do radio. That's all free, and it's all paid for by members like you at 877-500-5266. Same thing with Conch mentioning the archives, the film show and Between the Covers, and everything you heard today will be archived on our kboo.fm website. And again, that's all due to members like you, to listeners. 80% of our operating budget, Bill, comes from our members.
Yes, and to be a part of this 50-year celebration, make history with KBOO, dial us up at 877-500-5266, 877-500-5266, or kboo.fm/give. 50 years of radio. We know this is your favorite radio station. This is why you're listening in.
It's incredible when you think of it. KBOO started way back in 1968,
right?
Kind of the hippie ethos, and we're keeping that alive. But actually, it's a station devoted to you, to the community, and not just the community of Portland, but communities now because of the web all across the world. We bring people together, arts and culture, political activists. This morning we heard Greg Palast talking on Teresa Mitchell's Press Watch about voter suppression in the 2016 election, and hopefully we're a little bit more aware of it for the next election coming up in November. We had Flashpoints. We had Chris Andre and Air Cascadia. We had William T. Volman talking about climate change and global warming on his new two-volume book, Carbon Ideologies. That was on at 11 on Between the Covers. great programming like this, all due to members like you, not big corporations, not the government is not giving us big handouts. 877-500-5266 to keep KBOO going, hopefully another 50 years or more.
That's right. And again, 877-500-5266 is the number to dial. And KBOO.FM.